Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
I've known Jennifer for just over a year now. I've had the great privilege of being her student at the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies Introduction to Chaplaincy program. Jennifer is one of the core faculty members there. She's also a chaplain and an educator and a coach for people with suffering spiritual and emotional difficulties that might be connected with aging or sickness, dying, grief. I've learned a lot from Jennifer in the last year, and I asked her to come and speak to us to share some of her experiences, to talk about Buddhist chaplaincy. So the title of her talk that she's offered to us this evening is called The Way of Active Compassion, How Compassion Can Be Cultivated and Expressed as Service in a World Much in Need. So thank you, Jennifer, and welcome.
Thank you for the invitation, and hello to you all.
Jennifer, is it all right if we record this meeting?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for checking. Mm-hmm. Now I'm seeing myself, so it's like I'm talking to myself. So
sorry, you can go back to gallery view up in the corner if you want.
That's a recipe for disaster, so I'm going to even hide myself view. I love that feature. Yeah, okay.
Good.
So it's a pleasure and an honor to be invited to join you tonight. When Vanessa and I, when I said yes to this invitation, I imagined driving down the peninsula and being with you in person. And here we are together online. I'm relatively new, I'd say, at giving talks online, so bear with me. My thought about tonight would be to say some things to you about some of my thoughts about service work in particular, and then to break into small groups and have you talk to each other for a little bit of time about your experience. And I'm going to read you a Zen story before those groups so you can talk about the story. Yeah. And then we'll come back and we can just have some general discussion. So that's my thought about our time together. And I want to confirm again, what time should I speak my last word to you all? Is it 8:55 or 9?
We usually wrap up around 9, but then sometimes the discussion will go all the way to 9:30. So it depends. I'd say usually we have a talk for 30 minutes and then a discussion or Q&A for 30 minutes, but it's totally up to you. I think as long as we don't go past 9:30, we'll be all right.
Okay, great. Great. Thank you. That's helpful. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in New Jersey. If you've seen The Sopranos, those are my people. Bold, direct, talking at the same time, I mentioned that so you could understand a little bit about who I am and locate me and that aspect of who I am as a person, and some of the times the ways that I engage and teach and talk is pretty strident, and just to let you know that it's part of just my heritage to be that way. Yeah. And also, I've been in California about 20 years, but I still run into moments where people think we're having an argument, and I think we're having a discussion. So I think that's just the way it works for people who come from the East Coast to the West. Yeah. So I welcome discussion, and, you know, if you want to have an argument, we'll see. I'm up to it. No, I'm kidding. Can I just do a little polling maybe, by just raising hands if, any of you currently do some service work in the world, that you consider to be part of your, Zen practice? Raise your hands. Some. Okay, great. It's hard to tell with the people that aren't on screen, but, that gives me a little bit of an idea. Yeah. My roots of service go back to being a Girl Scout. Actually, I remember being very young, and there's actually something called the Girl Scout Promise. And when I look at it now, I see that it, in many ways, is similar to the Bodhisattva vow. And I don't think at the time I knew what would become of my life and what it would come to mean to me to take a vow. But I was an 8 or 9 year old girl holding up my hand and saying, and promising to, I think it's like this, to be a good person, to love God, and to serve my community. So that was pretty young, yeah. And that's pretty much been my path since then, yeah. And I still have my Girl Scout sash with all my badges, but it doesn't fit anymore, obviously. Yep. I came to the Dharma through the door of service. I had done some sitting, and I had lived in a yoga community where we did quite a bit of service. I know many people come to the Dharma through meditation, through engagement in Sangha. But for me, my meeting the Dharma was about service, and in particular being a volunteer with Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco, which is a Buddhist organization that began at San Francisco Zen Center decades ago, and is a place where people practice meeting old age, sickness, and death through serving other people, people who are ill, people who are soon or not so soon expected to die. So I really came in through the service doorway. And that's been true for me since. I'm more prone to service work than I am to meditation, just innately. One of my favorite times at Sesshin really is when we're all doing work practice together. That's like that and the tea and cookie time. So that tells you a little bit more about me. Yeah. Yeah. My view of compassion and practice and service is that the development of the heart is what happens that compels me to serve. And I think that particularly the Brahmaviharas are there to open our hearts, and that part of the spiritual path is that at some point there's a sense of, I want to move from the cushion, if you will, or my practice and my liberation and my meeting, whatever arises, to engaging out in the streets. So there's a move, just metaphorically, from the kind of the temple to the streets. And there we meet the world in all its distressing disguises. Yeah. And so for people who are relatively new to Dharma practice, I think the meditation practice and the forms are a foundation. And then from that comes an urge to help other people. Yeah. But then there's more that happens besides that, from what I've seen. So that is a awakening of compassion, an awakening of well, both innate compassion, and then our compassion grows through practice. Kind of like, I think of, if you've seen, I'm blanking, the Christmas show about the Grinch who stole Christmas. There's one part, the climax of it, when they show the Grinch's heart is really small, and then it grows and grows and grows, and he has a change of heart. So I think of practice like that. So we open, and then we want to serve others, and but then something else happens. There's a way in which service work can also be a way to avoid pain and suffering. In some ways, it can be a sense of, this is too much for me, so I'll go help somebody else. And perhaps you've noticed in your life that sometimes it's much easier to help other people with their whatever it is, you know, whether it's something as simple as, you know, that they're not good at balancing a checkbook, or they're not good at, or they need help just kind of focusing on something. But there's a way in which it can be a real avoidance of pain and difficulty in oneself. And so I think that's really natural, to go from, I want to help others, to, oh, this is great, because then I can, you know, sidestep some of my own stuff. Yeah. And then people come back around and think, well, you know, my doing service for others is a way to kind of give to society. And there can be almost some pride that arises, and some identity, a sense of dun-da-da-da, you know, I'm one of the superheroes now. I'm one of the bodhisattva warriors, you know, and we should all be wearing capes and big emblems on our shirts that say B for bodhisattva or something. So there could be a sense of like joining up with society to be a hero. But then something else happens. We come to realize that actually service nurtures our practice. It actually, just like chanting nurtures our practice, and taking the precepts nurtures our practice, and studying texts nurtures our practice, and fellowship in the Sangha nurtures our practice, and sitting nurtures our practice. Service actually begins to nurture our practice. It can make it a little more relative and not so absolute. So, for example, perhaps in my practice, I am contemplating patience and non-judgmental awareness, you know, which is fine and dandy on, let's say, a Wednesday night in Mountain View at a Zen Sangha. But then, you know, on Thursday afternoon, I'm on a city bus and somebody's inebriated and loud and bumping into people, and I get really impatient and just think to myself, when is this guy going to get off the bus? You know, so service work is like that, and it can show us the limits of our practice in some ways, and bring to awareness, there's the gap between my intention and my action, which is mental action, and I really wish I was on the other side of it, you know. So when I was doing hospice work, every time that we did our service work, we then sat together afterwards and talked about what arose for us in the context of service. And we did not talk so much about what happened with the people we were serving. In some ways, to give service, one also needs, I think, to really pay attention to what it's like to do service work. And the people that need or want or are the vehicle for service are very compelling. But I have found in some ways their stories can be heartwarming and important, but not if I'm focused on them and not on my own practice at the same time. Yeah. And then a little bit later in service down the road, there's a realization as I spend more time with people and their difficulties. So for example, people's grief, people's losses, people's the crises that they're in. There's a point at which in service work, we can wake up to the truth that their suffering is my suffering. And this is, I think this is a pretty liberating realization, and it comes and goes. I wouldn't say it's permanent, but what a novel idea, really. I mean, the world around us says, you know, do good and be a good person and help society. But this Dharma view of their suffering is my suffering, and then we are suffering together, or we are in suffering together, that can fundamentally change the way that I interact with somebody. And it really can bring me from the sense of I'm the helper and you're the helpee to we're in this together. We're just traveling through life, and today you, tomorrow me, so to speak. Yeah. There's a lot of temptations in service work, I think, to get focused on outcomes and if other people like what we're doing or if they get better. And I think in the long run, service work is a way to wake up, a way to be liberated, a way to see that, oh, we're all suffering and we're all doing our best, you know, and we're all living out lives that are formed by causes and conditions beyond our wildest imagination. Yep. I'm just breathing and thinking about what I want to say next. Just trying to really think more about myself and tell you more about myself. That's my bias is always to kind of tell my story. I think in cultivating compassion, in providing service, I actually didn't realize when I began that I would be engaging in an intimate and long-term relationship with the human condition. And not just mine, but the nature of human beings. So for example, I've met a lot of people who are really, really sick. Really, really sick. And my service to them, I don't really know necessarily the impact of it. Sometimes I do. And in the teaching that I do, I have more of a sense of it because I spend more time with people. But a lot of my work as a chaplain, I'm with people for 5 minutes or for 5 days. And then when I worked in a hospital, they would leave the hospital. Or when I worked in hospice, they would die or the families would no longer come. And so I've had to really practice with not knowing and come to see the, I don't know what the right word is. The first word that comes to my mind is impersonal, but that sounds kind of cold. But there's a warm, almost sense of the people that I've met, the people that I've journeyed with. I'm with them in extremely intimate, unusual times, and then I don't see them again. So I have to kind of be okay with that. And it's taken a while to kind of get used to it. And I think it's what's helped me do service work for a few decades is that I have not gotten overly involved and wrapped up in people's suffering as I'm working through my own by serving them. And so that's been very interesting to me. If I do run across people and they remember me, I'm usually rather pleased if I don't remember them right away, because if I did, it would be like I'm holding on to them as mine. And I don't see the people that I serve as mine at all. And even in teaching, I refer to people as the students and in the hospital, you know, the patients, and not, you know, my students or my patients. Like it's, these things do not belong to me. It's more like a two threads that just cross for a moment and keep going. Yeah. And I think that's the way it should be, actually. So here's one other story. I was in a hospital as a chaplain in the emergency room. A man and woman came in, and I was not there when they arrived, and I was called because the husband had died in the ER. And the woman was there. She was probably in her 50s with a teenage or early 20s child, and the child went out of the room, and I came in the room. And I spoke with her and offered a prayer, which was very meaningful for her as a Roman Catholic Filipina with an active Roman Catholic practice. And after a while, I thought, it's been 10 minutes, I should probably, you know, step away. This is not, you know, there's also a sense of I don't want to be a voyeur into people's process. And I wanted to leave. And she said, oh, no, you know, this is an important time and I need you here. And I said, okay, well, I'll stay and then your family will come. And she said, well, you're my family right now. And so that was a reminder to me to not underestimate the power of showing up for somebody when they're in a crisis. And I didn't do anything magical. I think I was present. I think I was open to whatever arose, and I didn't, I entered with just curiosity, and she came by my side and she held my hand, and it was amazing. It was amazing. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't read up on him or her, and I didn't follow up, and I kind of walked away. So there's also something about service that is really, I guess the word might be warmly anonymous. Warmly anonymous. And in the Jewish tradition, it reminds me, there's a practice of doing good deeds, but part of the practice is that nobody knows that you do good deeds. Some of you may be familiar with this. And so I like that idea. I think that's a little bit my style around service work. Yeah. So those are some of my thoughts on service work and practice. I think we're in the early decades of Western Dharma and service being a practice that's really known and tracked and described. And as time goes on, we're seeing more and more people doing Buddhist service, and that includes Buddhist chaplaincy. The course that I teach, we're in our 18th year of teaching it, and people come every year because they want to move from the cushion to the streets in some way. So I find that very encouraging. And isn't it lovely? Isn't it lovely that practice warms our hearts and helps us grow into caring people, you know? I originally came just to, you know, get out of my own stuff. And still that often drives me. And who knew that a side effect would be that I would have a sense of joy and gratitude, and that I would also find a way to pass on the lineage and to pay forward, if you will, the gifts that I've received that have enabled me to serve other people. I've been very fortunate in circumstances to have time, to have motivation, to have some talent, and some foolishness to keep going forward. So I feel particularly grateful to the San Francisco Zen Center community and teachers. And Les, I know you're part of that lineage. I'm very grateful. A lot of people did things that I don't know about from the past that I'm benefiting from now. So I hope that continues. Thank you. So I'd like to read you a story next. After I take a breath. And maybe take a moment to look at your faces too. Or your images, fascinating cats and trees and people's homes. Isn't it incredible to see people on screen? So nice, so interesting. So this is a Zen story, and I'd like you to listen to it, and then we'll break into small groups, and our host knows how to do that. Yes, let me just confirm that we can do that. Is that you, Bonnie?
Yes.
And you can break us into groups of...
Sure, how many groups would you like?
Let's do just groups of two, and then where there are two people on the same channel, that will become a group of three. How's that sound? Yeah, great.
There are two people on the same channel that will become a...
No, like there are two people, see where Marie and Paul are, or Marie Christine, like you can just, they'll pair up with
one group,
being three, yeah.
I see what you're saying. Okay, so we've got 5 by 5, so we got 25. Yeah. So I will break us into groups of 12.
After I read the story, cool.
Okay, after the story.
Yeah, thanks. There once was a Zen master who lived in a small village temple. Villagers would often come to him for help for both their spiritual and ordinary daily concerns. One day, a father of a teenage boy came to the priest to ask if he could somehow help with his son. His son had lost interest in everything but alcohol, gambling, and spending time with local thieves and scoundrels. This was a modern version. We could say he was probably always on the internet or playing games, electronic games, perhaps. The father had tried everything he could imagine to change his son's ways, but nothing made a difference. The father was convinced that the son was on a dangerous path. After explaining all this, the father begged the Zen priest to do whatever he could to help his son. Perhaps the priest could talk some sense into him. The priest agreed to meet the son and invited both the father and son to return the next afternoon for tea. When they arrived at the temple the next day, the priest graciously invited them in to a small tea room that was used for serving guests. The son, guessing why he had been brought there, remained somewhat withdrawn and ready to be defensive. The priest served tea and engaged both the father and son with simple conversation about the weather and recent events in the village. After a while, the priest indicated that the visit was over. Getting up to leave, the father was quite confused and disappointed. He had placed his last hope on the priest being able to talk sense to his son. Perhaps the priest had seen that the son's situation was hopeless, and so hadn't offered any advice or teachings for the young man. The priest followed them out to the anteroom where they were to put on their shoes. As the teenage boy knelt down to tie on his shoes, he suddenly saw a few drops of water falling onto his shoe. He looked up to see the priest standing above him. His eyes met the pained eyes of the priest and saw that tears were running down the priest's cheeks. From that moment on, the son was a changed person and soon became a respected member of the village community. So in your group, why don't you just have some discussion about anything I've said that's of interest to you, or from the story in particular, if you identify a little bit with perhaps the priest or the son or the father, or what touched you in the story. And we'll do this for 15 minutes. Maybe one person can talk for a few minutes, and then the other person can talk for a few minutes, and then you can have some discussion together. That way, as you talk for a few minutes on your own, you can just hear yourself, talk yourself into some integration or understanding, and then you can experience what it's like to be really listened to, and vice versa. Okay? And in groups of three, instead of using the last 5 minutes for discussion, you can use that last 5 minutes for the third person to take a turn. Sound good? All right, this is the hardest part of the whole night. If we can get through this transition, we're in good shape.
Okay, I'm going to break us out into groups now.
Thank you, Bonnie.
You'll have to accept the invite. Jennifer, by default, it's also going to add you to a room. Is that all right, or do you want me to move you out?
You can move me out. Thanks.
Okay. Let's see. All right, I'm setting a 15-minute timer. Let's see what happened with Chris and Brenda. Oh, Brenda, did it not work for you, or they didn't join your room, so you came back?
I was the only one in my room, so I thought I'd come back and hang out with you guys for a few minutes.
It's because it looks like Chris is away from her computer, so her or his. So I can add you to a different room. That's what I'll do.
It's okay, you know, because I'm going to have to go join my husband for dinner in a few minutes. So it's fine. I'm happy to just hang out with Jennifer and you for a few minutes if you want.
All right. That sounds good.
Yeah. Thank you, Jennifer. Could I ask you a question, Jennifer?
Sure.
Since we're here. One of the things that has concerned me in recent years is that it's sort of like, I guess, the balance between service and kind of self-care, or, you know, how to prevent burnout. I think I had a pretty good case of burnout a few years back, and I'm sort of coming back from that. I didn't really realize what was going on. But how do you feel, how do you see your way around that? How do you negotiate that in terms of, maintaining your balance and your compassion and, you know, being able to negotiate that?
Well, it's a very real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think everybody has it to one degree or another just from doing the work. You know, it's a little bit like, being exposed to radiation a little bit is fine, but a lot is too much, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's around us all the time, radiation, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think of it as the provider, the caregiver, the person caring for the other person, part of their responsibility is to monitor their own exposure and attend to it. And the trick is that a lot of people that do service work are not taught how to lessen their exposure or to how to offload that. And so there's just now beginning to be attention given to caregivers, because there's science now showing that it's a very real phenomena. You know?
Yeah.
In terms of practice, I see it as an ethical practice, actually. I think it's really serious.
So can you explain what you mean by that?
I think to overwork is actually unethical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not actually... it may not be beneficial. If somebody is hurt by providing a lot of service, then something's out of whack. And so just as we vow to do no harm, that includes ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so to hurt oneself from doing a lot of service work, which people do, and most people come to this the hard way, which is overdoing it and then, you know, entering again and that's also where I think peers are really helpful,
mm-hmm.
the community to help us monitor that or to be there for us when we need to do some restorative work or some resilience work. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense? Did I get to your question some?
Yes. Yes. I think, and do you have any specific ways or practice that you offload, as they say?
It's everything from ritual to rest to reevaluation to reflection and spiritual practice. So it's a bit of a combo. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
mm-hmm.
And I think ritual is a big one. That we need a place and we need a way to put what we experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some ways of providing care for others is like putting rocks in my pocket, you know, mm-hmm. and I need to take those rocks out every night, you know, mm-hmm. or regularly, you know, so that I'm not carrying them around because tomorrow I'm going to pick up more rocks.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the body is also a really good way to work through it unconsciously, you know, to just do a lot of movement or body activity, you know, body centered practice, including breathing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So those are just some, you know,
yeah,
things that I've seen, but it's really hard. It's very challenging.
Yeah.
Really, yeah. Because the work is very compelling. It's very compelling. It's like television. It can just draw you in and you don't realize that you've completely lost yourself.
Yeah. 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 For sure. For sure. That makes sense. Yeah. In terms of body work, anything specific that you found helpful?
You know, I just, it could be anything. It can be sitting, it can be walking, it can be dancing, it can be yoga, it can be running, it could be boxing, it can be archery. I mean, it's just, I think the body processes things.
That way. Makes sense. Yeah.
So, you know, it makes sense when people say, I love my walk home from the BART station, because that's when I, you know, leave it all behind so that I can then enter what's next. And that it kind of makes sense to me, you know.
Right. That's beautiful.
But, yeah. You know, And the body will also let us know, I think, if it's things aren't going well.
Right. It'll attract our attention somehow.
Yes.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much. I'm going to sign off early. I have to feed my spouse. but thank you very much for coming to talk to us.
You're welcome. It's nice to meet you.
Okay. Vanessa has spoken about you. And we're very happy that you could come tonight.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's very nice to hear.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye. Good night.
Good night, Brenda.
Good night. Bye, Bonnie.
All right, Jennifer, I think we're all back now.
Great. Well, I trust you had some good conversations. And I'm curious what there is to say now that you've heard me talk and you've talked to each other. I'm kind of open for thoughts or queries or complaints.
Umar, please unmute yourself.
Jennifer, what was that Jewish saying that you were talking about? When you do a good deed, forget it?
Almost. It's more that other people do not know that you did something.
Okay. Yeah, I come from Pakistan, and there's a saying that when you do a good deed, put it into the river.
And is that similar, in other words, that people won't see it because it's in the river?
Yeah. It just, you did a good deed, just put it in the river and forget about it.
Interesting. Interesting.
Send it downstream.
Send it downstream.
Send it downstream, and then somebody else will pick it up in the river?
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Vanessa?
Which just reminds me of a story that I read along the same lines about a friend of mine wrote in Istanbul. She's been researching these giving stones. Do you know about these? I only just learned about them recently. It's something from the Ottoman times. And they were set up as these like charity stones that they would have around town. And they were these really tall stones that were like just the height that somebody could reach. And so the idea was that if you could give, if you could leave something up there, you would sort of put it up there. And if you needed something, you would sort of feel up on top of the stone to feel if there was any money up there. But the idea of having it up here is that you could never tell if somebody was giving or taking. It was just engaging with the stone. So some warm anonymity in that too.
Warm anonymity.
Paul?
Jennifer, thank you so much for your talk tonight. Very inspiring.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
I was sharing in our little breakout group that I haven't done a chaplaincy, but it's something that I would like to do and aspire to at some point when the craziness of my Silicon Valley rhythm slows down a little bit. So thank you for your inspiration. I think maybe what I'm most struck with is just the authenticity that you bring to this, and just bringing your whole person, and that humanity. You know, I can feel it as you were presenting tonight, and I can tell when you're with others that that's one of the things that you bring too. Right, just being very authentic. It's a very powerful example. So thank you for that.
Yeah. That's really nice to hear. Thank you for telling me that. Yeah. You know, one authentic or stable person in the room can change a whole room. It's really quite remarkable, you know, no matter what seat they're sitting in. And I remember when I was first doing hospice work and asked, you know, like, what do I do when somebody dies? You know, the teaching, the great teaching was sit down, you know, like, you know, just settle in, you know, don't turn away or don't get flighty. And I think I've practiced that over and over again, and I found it to be really true. So when I meet people, particularly in a kind of a something like this or similar, my intention is to bring my whole self, because I think it's an invitation to others then to do the same. So thanks for noticing.
May? Thank you so much, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
I feel like you're melting away. You're melting us under your formless. And I have a question when you describe that you sounds like you were in many of the very intimate, both very intimate, also very intense moment, you know, in many people's life. And then I was particularly interested in that maybe you don't feel that because you already melted. I think we enter into that moment and then we out to that moment, and then you said you and then that particular person is like go parallel and just share that moment and then almost like forget each other. That's extremely beautiful. But extremely hard to do. What if in reality that say a certain person met you again and then and they remember you and then they want to thank you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes their thank you can be a burden, you know, believe me. And sometimes so how do you deal with that? How do you let it go? How do you practice equanimity? And then, something like that. I know you keep dissolving, and then, I mean, there's nothing attached, which is extremely beautiful.
You know, I think the things attached, but then I let them go. It's not like they never touch me. Yeah. Just for clarification.
True. And then which means that you are able to not let whatever, you know, those emotions or mental or emotional formation of other or energy, simply just the energy impact you, right? Usually, what did you do? Any challenge in the past, you know, you once go through, and then how did you go over that?
Well, I think some people absorb more than others. Yeah. So it could be that for me, as compared to somebody else, maybe yourself, I don't know you, but I'll just make an assumption based on your question that it goes in deeper, so it's harder. And so I think the way I think about it is exhaling, you know, in some ways an encounter is like a giant inhale, you know. But then I have to exhale, just, you know, just exhale. And the other thing I think to myself is, this is going to sound kind of odd, but I think of the precepts and not taking what's not freely given, you know.
Can you say that again?
To not take what's not freely given. So, you know, like whatever is true for the other person, if I hold on to it, it's like I'm taking it from them, or I'm you know, and so it belongs to them, so it needs to stay with them. Does that make sense?
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you know, it's just, it's not mine. It'd be stealing at some level, you know. But it's
sometimes it's not stealing, it's imposing, you know. Yeah. But I don't know how to tell the difference. Sometimes is that it's especially when you're young, you don't know. And then that's sort of like imposing, and you're just completely not aware of that. And then now you're aware. You say, "Oh my God, that was not mine."
Right. Yeah. And you know, it's so easy for you to hear my reflections, to make it seem like I've got this down, and it's been a pretty straight road in a certain direction. But you know, it's been a zigzag, two steps forward, one step back. I forget. I remember. And I think my thoughts that I share with you are from, you know, an arc of time. But you know, play by play, it's rigorous. Yeah, it's rigorous. Kind of like sitting, you know. I sit and I drift and I come back and I drift and I come back, and it's just like that kind of seven times down, eight times up.
Yeah.
I don't know if I got to the heart of what's on your mind, but thank you for the question.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Wei?
Hi, Jennifer. Hi.
Hi, Wei.
Yeah, thank you for the talk.
You're welcome.
I'm just wondering, what's your belief in death? Because you have been with a dying person for many times, and there are different beliefs on where people go when they die. Some people think they go to heaven and hell. Other people may think that's in reincarnation. And I'm not too sure exactly where people go. If you have any idea, can share with us.
Sure, sure. But first I want to ask you, what's that behind you?
Oh, this here? It's called applicate cloth. It's from Benin. I don't know if you know Benin. It's a country in West Africa. So I used to be a Peace Corps volunteer a while back, and I visited Benin to see voodoo. I don't know if you know voodoo. They have a voodoo museum.
I see.
So I went all the way there to see if I can find anything, something interesting in the museum. So I went all the way there to see that.
Interesting. Thank you. The images are very powerful, so they caught my eye. Yeah. And so you must be a seeker if you went all that way for voodoo, and now you're asking me about death. So you've got the big questions going on, don't you, Wei? I love it. So here's, you asked me, and this is just me. I honestly think we're not supposed to know. And every time I sit with somebody and they've died, I cannot make any sense of it. It's a profound mystery. I think if we did know something about our ability and our will to live would be diffuse. I just hold it as a great divine mystery, as incomprehensible as helium and hydrogen getting together to create matter, or as unexplainable as octopus and that they have beaks. I mean, who made the octopus, you know? So I hold it in all of that for me, you know. So for me, it serves me to not be so certain. I'm okay with holding that uncertainty as a mystical inquiry rather than some sort of that I haven't thought it through or something.
So it's a surprise. It's going to be a surprise.
Sure. Maybe a great surprise or, yeah. I mean, I like the idea of heaven, you know, but what if this is heaven? What do you think?
Actually, I used to think when I die, if I know where I'm going, I will go to the right place. If I don't have any idea, I will get lost. That's one moment in time that I can make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of either you know where you're going or you get lost somewhere in space. I don't know. That's a theory.
Thank you. So you want to make sure you're not lost, if I'm hearing you right.
I don't know. It just, to me, all of this is just a joke in some way. You know, I mean, the world, I don't know. I just enjoy while we can.
Yeah. Yes.
Dave?
I was very struck by several of the examples you gave of how not to do chaplaincy, particularly hospice chaplaincy, and just more generally to not, for example, see yourself as the Buddhist superhero or to distance yourself from the suffering of others or to cling to the suffering of others that belongs to you, then you're so noble and so forth and so on. There's so many pitfalls. And it kind of reminded me of something that happened when my mother was dying. And the young neighborhood minister from the Protestant church that my parents went to came by for a chaplaincy visit. And he said to me, "Well, you know, we're all dying all the time anyway." And that just struck me as a particular lack of skillful means on his part. It made me so angry and it was so unhelpful. And the fact that it's true made it hurt even more.
Mm.
I'm very respectful of the level of sensitivity and skill that needs to go into that kind of chaplaincy and the many pitfalls that you have to be careful to avoid. And the importance of really tuning into what the other person needs as opposed to just having some sort of a pat formula in mind about how you're going to fix it.
Yeah. Well, that was a very important moment in your life. I'm sad to hear it didn't go so well.
One other thing that really struck me when my mother died was that we are so unfamiliar with death in our modern Western civilization. I had never been around a dead person before until she died. And I had heard that people would sit with a loved one after they died, sit by the side of the bed. And I'd never understood that until I did it. And then I understood.
What was her name?
Marjorie Day.
Marjorie Day. in some ways, I think it's a real, it's a large gift for somebody to know that they're dying and that other people will be with them once they've died, you know. It's generous of her and you to meet each other in that way at that time. Not easy, and you're right, we don't get a lot of instruction. But as I'm sure you discovered, it's relatively natural. You know, it's not rocket science.
It's like the old saying about Zen itself, simple but not easy.
Right. Yeah, and you know, it's only in the last 100 years that people have forgotten how to be with people when they're dying. Not even 100, maybe 50 years, you know. Because once upon a time, there weren't places to bring people, or there weren't medical staff to kind of take over the scene, you know. So these two together are still working stuff out, I think. Thank you for telling me a little bit about yourself and your mom.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments?
Did you guys like the story?
I'll actually make a comment about the story. I mean, just what impacted me was that all the advice in the world doesn't really help. And a lot of times I think our impulse is to try to help people by giving advice and trying to correct them and trying to, you know, help them better their lives. But really what makes a difference is just us caring. That was the silent tears. Just mm-hmm. us really caring and not giving advice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very deep truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll leave you with a teaching from Rachel Naomi Remen, a physician and teacher, and she writes about service, and she says, when we try to help other people, at some level we see them as weak when they need help. And that when we fix people or want to fix people, we see them as broken. And then when we serve people, we see them as whole and complete. So I think all three are true. Two are great temptations, and one is the way forward. So I'll leave you with that.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Really wonderful talk today.
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's kannondo.org.